I was given a helpful caution before the lunch break. We were asking you to write affirmation to somebody who is difficult for you to affirm. And just as Craig said, it probably is not a good idea to give that book to somebody and say, here, you need this. It probably wouldn't be helpful for you to write a note of affirmation to someone and say, I was tasked to write a letter to someone who's difficult to affirm, and you qualify. Congratulations. You're the first name I thought of. You know, those. If they don't know you have that assignment, they can be the person who's hardest for you to affirm, and it would be a good exercise, a good discipline for you to do. But yeah, you have to use some tact and remember the context and all this. That was a helpful caution, and I'm glad that was said. And there'll be some other nuances. In fact, this third session is helping people get good at affirmation nuances and guardrails to maximize fruitfulness and avoid regret. This won't be an exhaustive catalog of everything that can keep this from derailing, but we'll try to give you just a handful of things that have helped me as I've made mistakes through life, and try to keep you from making the same mistakes I made. You can learn from my mistakes. At the end of this fourth session, we're going to open the floor, I think, for Q&A. Is that right, Craig or Jim? Yes. So if you had some questions kind of percolating in your mind, jot them down. And in the fourth session, I think that's why these microphones are here. So we'll try to open an avenue for you to ask questions. I don't claim that I'll have the answers, but I'll take a stab at trying to respond or just say, that's a good question or something like that. And we'll collaborate together. And all the answers don't have to come from me. You know, somebody in here could ask a question and somebody over there could say, well, here's what I found helpful. And so I'm very eager to learn from you as well. I want to show you something that I've brought all the way from a great distance to be with you, and I have not seen it. And I bought it from a person who's not seen it, who got it from a supplier who's not seen it, who bought it from a farmer who's not seen it. None of us have seen it. Nobody has ever seen it, and I want to show it to you, and if you want to see it, that is. That'll be a little later. It's after lunch. You have to think of ways to keep people awake, you know, during this. Seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth, and he taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are they that mourn, I think, over their sin, for they will be comforted. And blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they will be filled. And blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice, be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. You're the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost his saltiness, how will it be salted again? It's thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and trodden under the boot of men. You're the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a basket, but on a candlestick, and gives light to all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father, which is in heaven. And think not that I've come to destroy the law or the prophets. I've not come to destroy, but to fulfill. I tell you the truth, till heaven and earth pass, not one stroke or one dot will in any wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whoever therefore will break one of the least of these commands and teach others the same, he'll be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever will do and teach them the same will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you this truly, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you'll in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. So now we ask for miraculous grace, justification by faith, so that our righteousness will not only exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, but that he who knew no sin would become sin for us, that we might become. The righteousness of God in him. Help us rest not on our formulas, not on our methods, not on technologies, not on practicing affirmation, but rest on Jesus. That's the help I'm asking for now as we go forward here in his name and for his sake. Amen. So you saw it there in the Sermon on the Mount that we are to let our light shine before men. We're to do good works that are seen, but not to be seen by them, but seen by them so that they glorify our Father which is in heaven. So that's how I'm thinking of practicing affirmation, God-centered praise of those who are not God, that they watch how we affirm people and God gets the glory for them. He gets the credit. So now we're not cocky about we're so good at giving affirmations. We just see good stuff around and we talk about it. That's what we're wanting to have happen because we're focusing on these things this weekend. So, gain a reputation. Give so many affirmations as a consistent pattern, as a way of life, that you gain a reputation for it. So, what reputation do you want? Mr. Krabby Pants, Old Lady Battle Axe, Miss Nitpick, or Barnabas, Son of Encouragement? You know, that's not his given name, you know. So, how did he get that name? By living a certain way. It became a pattern, became reputation for him. And so, what is your name? What is your name? When people know you very long, what is your name with them? We're all building a name. You know, that name, Abraham Lincoln, was just a name once upon a time. Just another name. Like, I don't know, Joshua Johnson, or who's that? I don't know, Abraham Lincoln, just another name. But he lived consistently in such a way that he filled up his name with meaning so that his nickname was Honest Abe. How would you like a character quality to be your nickname? That would be cool. That would be good. It would be honoring to God, I think. Jesus was just another name. There are a lot of Jesuses. But he lived in such a way that he filled it up with the designated meaning. You'll call his name Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. So he lived in such a way and continues to live in such a way that he saves his people from their sins. And so he's known as Savior. He's known as Redeemer. He's known as Good Shepherd. He's known as Door. These names reflect the way he is, the pattern, the character that's established for him. You can also ruin a name. I have a friend who changed his name because of the way somebody else lived. My friend's name is Adolf. Adolf Johnson changed his name. He now goes by A. Richard Johnson. Everybody knows him as Dick. A lot of people don't even know what the A stands for. Because there was somebody else who lived in such a way as to ruin that name. And not a whole lot of people are naming their kids Adolf these days. Or Judas. Who names their kid Judas? He wrecked that name. And we have, for some reason, there's a trend. A trend. Not the trend, but there's a wave. A lot of Samuels in our church back home. And I looked on our database. We've got over 100 Samuels now at our church. And I write these little persons and say, you are an extra motivation for me to live in such a way as to not ruin your name that you and I share. And you fill up your name's meaning. You gain a name, a reputation, by how you live. Okay, so now I said I brought this thing that no one has seen and I've not seen, and the guy I bought it from hasn't seen it, and he bought it from a farmer who's never seen it. And I'd like to show it to you if you'd like to see it. Some of you would like to see it, those who are still awake after lunch here. And after I show it to you, no one will ever see it again. So, I mean, you could take a photo, I suppose, and go home and show people a photo of it, but I have it in a transparent plastic bag, though I've not seen it. Some of you might maybe running ahead and you're thinking, I think I know what this is, you know, whatever. But, so I'm going to get it out of this bag and I'll show you what it is, and it relates to your name, I hope, if I'm any good at this. What I have here is, some of you at least that are down close can tell what this is. Peanut. This is not the part I want to show you. The part I want to show you is inside. Nobody's ever seen this before. Should there be a drum roll or something going on? It's not all that exciting because you have seen the inside of other peanuts, but you've never seen the inside of this one. Ladies and gentlemen of Escondido, there you are. Nobody's ever seen this before. Now, I'm going to do something dramatic with this. Before your very eyes, I'm going to turn this peanut into a human being. Some of you are incredulous. It is amazing, but it's not rare. Now, what's happening with the peanut? Audience participation. What's happening? It's losing its identity. It's going down in assimilation, digestion, and it's going to, in a few days from now, if I help a little old lady across the street, that peanut will be helping the little old lady across the street, in part, right? But that peanut cannot become me if it stays a peanut. It has to lose some of its peanut qualities, give them up, die to those, fall to the ground, be ground up, to become a part of something bigger, something better, something living. And one of my heroes is George Washington Carver, who invented over 300 uses for the peanut, from medicine to cosmetics to paint to explosives to insulation, adhesives, lots of things that he made out of the peanut. He went into his laboratory, actually, and he prayed. He's a Christian man. Anybody been to his museum in Missouri? Yes. I find it worthwhile. Lots of his quotes are in there. And he prayed, Lord, show me the secrets of the universe. And he felt like God's response came back, too big. Ask for something more your size. So he said, okay, show me the secrets of mankind. And the answer came back, ditto. Still too big. So he prayed, show me the secrets of the peanut. And God gave him these hundreds of inventions out of the peanut, which has really created a market to this day for the peanut, which was not a very marketable commodity when he was praying this prayer. Well, all of the things that he has built out of the peanut are the way you build your name. Namely, he had to crush the peanut. And we build our names best in adversity. That's where character really shines. The character of Christ comes through when it isn't easy for the character of Christ to come through. And I'm saying that about our own character, and I'm saying about that's when to look for it in other people. when things are really tough and they're under financial pressure, or there's a health issue, or they've lost a loved one, or there's a time pressure, or there's confusion, or they're in a battlefield, or whatever's going on, that's a good place to look for the grace of God in terms of character, and it's a good place to develop character and not run from the difficulties, but to receive them. James said, count it all joy, brothers, when you encounter these many trials, knowing, if you don't know this, you won't do it, knowing that the trying of your faith produces patience, one of these qualities of Jesus. Let patience have her perfect work that you may be complete, like Jesus, lacking nothing. That comes in adversity. Paul said the same thing in Romans 5. So, it's not like, you know, when life clears up and things are easy, then I'm going to work on character. Or, you know, when we get through this rough spot, then I'll watch for things to affirm. Nope. When it's tough, that's when character is developed and when it's displayed most brightly. And I want to offer that as hope to not be, to grow weary and become disheartened about pursuing character and looking for it. So what is your name? Generally, our failure to affirm others is not rooted in them, but us. So when I said, find someone who's difficult to affirm and affirm them, the problem could be in them. They just could be a walking bundle of mess, a real project, and you can't think of much to affirm about them. That's possible. But generally speaking, our failure is not in them. It's not their fault that we don't behave a certain way. Our character in affirming is on us. So let me tell about Wayne. It's not his real name. But when I taught in the public schools, I taught sixth grade, and I had an agreement with the administration that I wanted all the fatherless boys in my class. And I knew I was asking for a chore. But all the other women in my particular school were females. And I wanted these boys, these fatherless boys, to have a male in their life. I'll say role model, but I don't mean perfect. I'm not perfect, far from perfect, but I'm a better male role model than all the female teachers were in our school. And I wanted these boys to have a male role model. And the administration was happy to go along with that. So I got all the fatherless boys, and a lot of them were a piece of work. And one year I got Wayne. Wayne was antisocial. He was dangerous. He was a sociopath. He carved up furniture. One time he took toothpicks in, and he jammed them in all the locks on the outside of the school, and then put chewing gum in around the toothpicks so that when the custodians came to open up the building on Monday, there's no place to put a key. Key wouldn't go in. So they had to break in to open up the school for that day. If you sat in front of him, he might write on you. He might write on your clothing. He might cut your hair. He might cut your clothing. He might cut you. He would make projectiles out of erasers. He'd take these cube-shaped erasers and drive pins through them in all different shapes, directions, and say, here, catch. And if you catch it, you bleed. If you don't catch it, you bleed. He hated school. He said it before he even entered the building the first day in the fall. We're lining the kids up outside. I hate school. It was his mantra. I hate school. And so I've got a challenge in front of me, and I think it generally will be a good idea if Wayne listens to his teacher. Not because I'm perfect, not because I'm God, but I think it'll be generally a good idea if he listens to his teacher. And what is your name? Yes, Audrey. Audrey, you're going to be Wayne, okay? I had to keep Wayne's desk separated from all the other students because he would cause damage. Always had to keep one eye on Wayne. And I'm thinking, I want Wayne. I want to get Wayne's attention. I want him to listen to me. So before lunch, you heard that people tend to be influenced by those who praise them. So I got to find something to praise about this guy. Wayne was not His grades were terrible. He's antisocial. Nobody likes to play with him on the playground. He was not musical. He was not athletic. So I'm fishing and prayed, Lord, what can I affirm in Wayne? One day I'd given an assignment and I'm moving around in the classroom. I don't know if I'm going to cause feedback here, but I'm just moving. Students would raise their hand and I'd come over and I'd help them with whatever they were working on and keeping one eye on Wayne. As I was moving around through the class, I happened to see that Wayne was not doing his homework. No surprise there. He was not doing the project. But he was daydreaming out the window. I could tell he was deeply engrossed in whatever he was thinking about. He had his hand in his chin like this, and he just was just drilling a hole in the window, just looking out. And I thought, he's not killing anybody. I'll take it. And so I came up behind him. And I just put my hand on his shoulder like this and said, Wayne. And he jerked up and looked at me like, what did I do now? Which was, usually had done something now. I said, I can tell you're deep in thought. I like that about a guy. I like a guy who's a thinker. And I just left him. I can still see the look on his face. The look said to me, so that is what a compliment feels like. He didn't use those words. I don't know if he knew the word compliment. But it was like, that really felt good. And so I just kept moving around through the class, and I'm helping the students, keeping one eye on him. And I would notice, as I would turn his direction and look over his way, he'd do one of these. What's happening? People are influenced by those who praise them. This is powerful, and it's wasted. It's a key, and we don't pick it up. Stick it in and turn. Now, I'd like to say he went on and graduated as valedictorian, and he was called into the ministry, and I've lost track of him. I don't know where he is. But I use his example because he was so far out on this end as sociopathic. He just was dangerous to be around. He didn't smell good. And one compliment. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, he doesn't have to do his assignments and he can sit and daydream out the window all day. I'm not saying that. I'm encouraging incremental progress towards what we want. And he... At Christmas, he brought me a Christmas card that he made by hand. I don't remember all what it said, Merry Christmas, Mr. Crabtree, or something, and he gave me this handmade card, and he stood there while I opened it, of course, because he wants to know that I'm liking it, and I'm liking it. And then he said, as he walked out for Christmas, he said, I still hate school. So he didn't want to compromise on his moral position, but he knew that he was giving evidence that I wasn't all bad with him, that I might possibly by spring, I might be okay with him, possibly. It's not a popularity contest. It's an influence thing. I want to be able to speak into his life. And I just tell this story because that little moment right there illustrates the power of this thing, I think. And God's, I didn't invent this. I didn't make this up. I'm just looking around thinking, does this really work? I was talking to a Campus Crusade for Christ staff, now called Crew, gathered from 5 states in Indiana, talking about this subject a few years ago. And there was a break, like we just had. After the break, a guy that had been sitting down over here was absent. He wasn't there. He didn't come back. And so we went on with, I wasn't just talking about practicing affirmation there. I had several subjects I was assigned. And so went on to the next subject. And at the subsequent break, he approached me. And he said, I don't know if you noticed, but I wasn't there in that last session. And I didn't say, yeah, I noticed, but I did notice. And he said, I just want to tell you what happened. He said, when you were talking about you can't win for losing, I cannot please you, All you do is criticize me. He said, I recognized myself and my 14-year-old son. I have a 14-year-old son at home, and he and I almost have not spoken for 2 years. We live in the same house. And he's a good boy. But I'm always on his case. I can see it now. I can see it. Nothing's good enough. Straighten up. Brush your hair. Tuck in your shirt. Got your homework done? Did you park your bike? Don't park it there. Park it over there. So I determined at the break that I was going to call my son and not complain about anything, but just tell him that I'm grateful that he's my son, and I think he's a good son. And I figured he had some other thing he was going to say, some particular thing about his son that he appreciated. So I called my son. This is in the days before cell phones. And I called my son long distance, which said something right there. I'm paying money for this phone call, extra money to talk to my son. And I just said, son, I'm here away, and I'm thinking about you, and I'm glad that God has given you as my son. And hope you're doing well there, and blah, blah, blah. And he said, my son started talking, and he talked for 45 minutes. He says, I wasn't going to hang up. One phone call after 2 years. I tell you, this is a key. It is a key to opening relationships that have been closed or at least sticky, or there's been a lot of drift. You can start pulling it back in. Or, 14-year-old, when one of our daughters turned 11, this is our daughter, I'm picking up on the same thing. It was as though overnight, like that, all the knowledge in the universe was transferred to her because no one needed to tell her anything. She knew it all. And in that same instant, it was sucked out of everyone else so that her dad didn't have anything to offer her. And I'm thinking this is not a good place for her to be. It's not good for an 11-year-old not to listen to her dad. Again, as I said this morning, not because her dad is all wise or perfectly good, but because God thinks that 11-year-olds should listen to their dads. And right during those days, Josh McDowell was on the end of his Why Wait campaign. I don't know if some of you remember his Why Wait sexual purity campaign. And I remember on a radio interview one time he was asked, what's this campaign all about? And he said, I think it's a quest for daddy's arms. Meaning, if a young woman can't get the affirmations and acceptance and belongingness and affection from her dad who wants nothing from her, she'll go get it from someone who would be happy to take something from her. And I'm thinking, my 11-year-old daughter is very vulnerable right now. She won't listen to me. She'll probably listen to somebody else. So I prayed, Lord, my goal, and I'm not exaggerating, my goal is I want her to get more affirmation from me than anybody else on this planet. Can we pray that way? I hope so. I did. I think there's warrant. I want her to get dump trucks of affirmation from me. Now, I'm going to qualify that in a little bit here. If I have to stay up nights thinking of ways to affirm her, Lord, keep me up. So I started looking. I'm just observing. And she's not Wayne. She's a nice gal. She's a very nice gal. And there's lots to affirm about her. She's intelligent and bright and funny and lots of just one of my favorite people, actually. And so I start commending her. And one day, I walked past her bedroom. The door was open. She was in there. And our two daughters back in those days were very different. Her sister was very orderly. All of her shoes were in pairs and almost miraculous. And all of her clothes were hung in the closet in color-coded hangers. So, you know, like all the pink hangers are blouses and the green hangers are slacks or, I don't even, is slacks a word? Whatever. All of her stuffed animals are arranged maybe by height or something. She just was, but now this daughter was there was a contrast between the two. And she used what could be called MBO, management by observation. That is, leave everything where you can see it, and then you know where it is. So I walked into her room that day, and I'll use this. Okay, on her dresser, I noticed that she had lined up the stuff that the tallest things were in the back, stair-step down, and the shortest things were in the front, which has multiple benefits. For one thing, you can see everything because the short stuff's here. If you put the short stuff in the back and the tall stuff in the front, you don't know if the short stuff is there. And if you have to climb over it to find it, oh, then you're knocking things over in the front and everything. So it just makes sense. And now, today, you can buy these little stair-step organizers, can't you, for your spice rack and stuff. Yeah, okay. I like to think my daughter invented that maybe. But so here's what I did. I just said, I see the method here. I see your plan. This is great. I think this is something God would do. Can you put God in compliments? I hope to tell you. I am telling you. God does everything decently and in order. He's the most orderly being in existence. Nothing's out of order with God. And I think to commend people by telling them they're like God, even if it's in a little measure, that's where we want to go. And God is helping you be like Him in this. This is, I get it. Well done. And I, you know, ignored the rest of the tsunami and went about business. And it was a little while later, just a few minutes later, I was walking past the kitchen and looked down the hall into the kitchen, and she was in there hugging Vicky back there. And I just stopped mid-action, mid-step like this, said, oh, I love that. I love when an 11-year-old is hugging her mother. I think it's good for the mother. I think it's good for the 11-year-old. It makes this dad happy. I think it makes God happy. Can I talk that way? Okay, how long does that take? Seconds. And then I just went on. Just have this little party for just a few seconds. And I'd say no more than 10 days probably. She's back. She's listened to me. She's a mother of four children now. And she has called me to ask, Dad, what would you think if I did thus and such? And I just marvel. I just think, you don't need my opinion. You certainly don't need my permission that you'd call me and ask my opinion about this. Okay. I'm talking about the power of this. When you've worked down through, they don't listen to your corrections and they don't listen to you and they're oppositional, you can dig out to the place where not only will they accept your corrections, they'll ask for them. Say, I'm thinking about doing something, I want to bounce it off of you, which I do with Vicky regularly. Thinking about doing this, that, or the other thing, and you know, before I go public with it and embarrass myself, I want to bounce it off somebody who will be ruthlessly honest in love. And you can so gain back a platform of active relationship that you can exchange criticisms with it. It's not hard because, you know, the context is love, affirmation, blessing, commendation. If I say something negative to you in that context, it's because you've already received your trainload of positives. You know I'm all for you. And I'm not picking on you and not harboring some grudge or something like that. So I use our 11-year-old as a reminder to myself to keep the affirmations coming. Why did they go away? I didn't get up in the morning and say, I hate that girl. I'm not affirming her anymore. She's had her quota. I've met the limit. There's nothing more good to say about her. I've said it all. No, we just get busy with life. We just get preoccupied and distracted and tired. And that's what happens. It's that prevailing wind that we saw with the arrow that was up here a while ago. It just keeps pulling us in a certain direction. And so a seminar like this or reading the book or something is just a way to say, start the engine and pull the other way here in your relationships. Oh, pig farmer's wife. I could do more of these. I'll stop with this one. I was talking to a pig farmer's wife and about this, and his relationship, he has three daughters. His relationship with his daughters was not in any trouble, nor with his wife. It's pretty healthy, happy home. But he said, I'm going to go home, and I'm going to really focus on this. And so, as a pig farmer, he would, as he was out feeding the pigs in the morning, he'd think, you know, that was a great breakfast, and I don't think I said anything about it. So he kept a little seed corn booklet in his pocket, and he'd pull out that thing, breakfast. Put it back in his pocket, go on with whatever, and later he'd be hauling manure or whatever he was doing on the pig farm, and he would think, you know, my three daughters wear these cute little pigtail thingies. Didn't even know what to call them. Said, I wouldn't know where to buy them or how to put them in, but they're cute, and I like them. And so he, you know, hair thingies. Then when he'd come in for lunch, he'd take his notebook, set it down by the sink while he washed his hands, and he'd say, you know, dear, I don't think I told you how much I enjoyed that breakfast this morning. I was still thinking about that breakfast in the middle of the morning. And our girls, I don't know where you get those little things or how you put them in or anything like that, but whatever you're doing there, keep that up. I like that. That's good. What's for lunch? Not particularly romantic or articulate, but she called me. It was long distance again, back in the days of long distance. She called me and she said, you've been talking to my husband. And I said, well, yeah. How's it going? And this is, she said one word, two words, and this is how she said it. It's wonderful. So you can take a relationship that's already good and sweeten it with this. And there's some relationships you have that are very healthy. This isn't just for broken, shattered, you know, relationships that are on the rocks. This is for all relationships. I've argued all day that this is universal. It applies everywhere. Just that we forget to do it. We get anything, oh, that relationship's in good shape. I don't need to do any affirmations there. Or, you know, I got other things I got to get done. And, well, okay, you can unplug the refrigerator if you want. Or not weed that garden. But the weeds will come. I feel like I should tell one more. I don't recommend moratoriums on correction. There was a family whose father was somewhat of a drill sergeant with the kids. Good boys. You'd be happy to have this family in your church. And the suggestion was made to him, just declare a moratorium. Why don't you just try a one-week experiment. Go home and just don't correct anything for a week. First of all, see if you can do it. Because the constant conveyor belt of corrections is about you, not just about them. And so if your sons burn the house down, just say, you guys really know how to build a bonfire. You know, or whatever. And he agreed. He said, I think this is overdue. It's on me. And so he went home. His wife called. They're from another state. His wife called me. That's why I can remember these two stories. They're so parallel. What did you talk to my husband about? I said, well, why do you ask? She said, my husband, this was on a Monday. We talked Saturday. She calls on a Monday. My husband is in the other room wrestling with our three boys. I can't remember the last time they wanted to wrestle with their dad. Now, again, I don't want to put everything on this key that I'm reminding you that you have this weekend, but I just think this is trajectory altering in relationships. And you have the key. Put it to work. Use it. Okay. This is an advance alert. Later today, after the break, in the next session, we're going to ask for testimonials of how you have personally seen the practice of affirmation make a difference. Maybe somebody affirmed you and it really made a difference and you decided to stay with your piano lessons, or I don't know, something. Or it could be some affirmation that you provided to someone else and it made a difference for them. I don't know. Or maybe something you heard about. You weren't even personally involved. Fine. But it's going to be an audience participation thing that's coming later, so you can think of whether there's an instance or an episode or vignette in your experience that would be edifying to us in the context of a conference like this. We will become profoundly ineffective in our relationships if we've squandered a hearing. Remember, people are more likely to be influenced by those who praise them. You earn a hearing through this. We talked about that earlier. If we've squandered a hearing, alienated our listeners, and turned them off to us, and this isn't working. There we go. Even if we're right and not wrong, you can have exactly the right correction to bring to someone. They won't take it from you. They have blacked you out. You have onion breath as far as they're concerned, or what, something like that. They don't send me an email. I don't want to talk to you. Or if you've squandered a hearing, as we're talking about, they won't listen to you even if you possess the jurisdiction, the right, and even the responsibility to say something, like you're their dad, or you're their supervisor, or you're their pastor, or you're their small group leader. And it's your job to say something about whatever's out of alignment there. Might not hear it from you. Or even if you apply wise and loving rationale. Now I want to tell you about this because, and I've got these reasons why this is important to you and it's important to your future and you should listen to me. And no, they won't. I'm just telling you. If they've tuned you out, they've tuned you out. So thereafter, whatever you say, it can be right, it can be loving, it can be rational, it can be biblical. They've tuned you out. Talk to a wall. Even if you have good motives, you mean well by them, you love them, you don't want them to make a shipwreck of their life like Hymenaeus and Alexander. And you love the person deeply, and you care about the outcome of their faith, and you just so badly want life to go well for them. Doesn't matter. If they've been turned off to you by you, they won't hear your input. They won't take it from you. And you can have even exactly the right wording and the right tone. You can say it as though you were speaking to the Queen of England, with all respect. There's a lateness. The people around us are likely to stop hearing us over time if we don't practice affirmation toward them, even if he understands the psychology of human development. Ah, something happened in my slides here. Let me go back here. Huh. The he should be we. Even if we understand the psychology of human development, you can know everything from a zygote on through childhood and concrete thinking to abstract thinking. And you can know that whole continuum there. You can understand it. They don't care. Well, you know the old adage. They don't care how much you know till they, yeah, know how much you care. And one of the ways to show how much you care is affirm what's going on there. Even if we understand biblical theology of man and sin, which we're going to come to in just a moment, even if we understand management best practices, how to do things. I've been to a seminar on practicing affirmation. You should listen to me. They don't. If we know the difference between right and wrong, it can be squandered on the fact that we've not affirmed them and we've lost a hearing with them. They don't hear us anymore. Okay, Ephesians 4:29. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up. Good for what? Yeah, say it again. Yeah, good job. Building up as fits the occasion. So there's a context, there's an occasion that it may give grace to those who hear. You want to give grace, and grace in this context is enablement. You want your words to enable them to do what would be good for them to do. Proverbs 12:18. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. All right, so picture me here with my sword or my lightsaber or what have you. And how long does it take for me to cut you? Not long. An instant. How long does it take to heal? Long. Could it leave a mark? Yeah. Could it amputate? Yeah. Words are like that. So what this says, there are some words that are like a sword thrust. Don't use them. Careful. But the tongue of the wise brings healing. So the sword thrust thing sometimes is impetuosity, and we're out of control, and we say things, and then, oh, why did I say that? So stupid that I said that thing. Anybody ever had that feeling? Okay, me and a few of you. We'll get together during the break and say mean things about the rest of the people in here that are not telling the truth. But the healing part, you can organize for that. You can get your ointments and your wraps, your bandages together, and your pillow to lift up that limb and prop it up. And you can, that's what I'm saying about affirmation. These words that heal, you can strategize to do it. That's why you'd spend all day here thinking about it and read a book on it and that sort of thing. So here are some nuances or some guardrails to put around affirmation. And this session is over at 2:30? 2:35. Okay, here we go. Whoops, back up. Unattached to correction. Somebody was talking to me about this at the break. It's best if you affirm people totally apart from correcting anything in their performance, their behavior, or their attitude, or anything like that. You just give them good news. There was a man who ran a business, and he practiced what he called the sandwich method, meaning if he had to scold one of his employees, he would commend them for something, and then he'd lower the boom, and then he'd follow up with a commendation of some kind so that they'd know that, you know, he still valued them as an employee and that sort of thing. Well, the only time that he did the Oreo cookie part was when he was going to get to the nasty cream part in there, and his employees began to notice the pattern. And he called it the sandwich method. They called it the bologna sandwich. Because they thought, here was the dynamic. He starts saying something commendatory to you, and you know the pattern. What are you doing inside? Battening down the hatches, up come the defenses. Thinking, okay, here it comes. And you're not listening to what he's saying. You've tuned that out already. And then he lowers the boom. And then he follows up with something nice. Well, you're not thinking about the follow-up thing. You're thinking about that thing that he just said. That's not fair, because if I had the resources that other department had, and besides, two of my employees in my department were sick, and we were really under deadline that day, and blah, 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 you know, and you're trying to make your inner lawyer, as Paul Tripp would say, is making its case right then, so that they didn't listen to the affirmations, even though there were twice as many affirmations as there was correction. And I'm arguing here, try to keep them apart if you can. You can't always, but when you can, do. Then it should be a steady diet. Don't save them up. Every year on your birthday, I'm going to give you one affirmation for every day. So here's your book of 365 affirmations for this year. It won't have the same effect. It has to be kind of the air you breathe in your relationship. It has to be the way you are, not just something you do towards them. Then they need to be honest. It won't work if you fabricate. And let me make this point right here. I'm going to interrupt this program for this commercial. A caution regarding honesty. While faint praise is damning, exaggerated praise is by definition false. So if Vicky says to me, Sam, I just think you're the smartest man in the whole world. Why are you laughing? Because she's laughing, yes. So am I. Because we smell something's up. This is a joke or a trap. Exaggerations. I'm not saying exaggerate praise. Find praise that's true, and then say it to them. That's what I mean by honest. Did I want to say something else about honesty? Well, lots of things could be said, but I think we'll just move ahead. And then God-centered, we've been trying to highlight that all day long. If you can make explicit the connection between God and what you're seeing in that person. I regret that when I commended Wayne for being a thinker, you know, that's a God thing. It's God who says, come, let us reason together. God is behind reasoning. And I didn't draw it out in that conversation right then. I wish I had. I didn't. Blew it. We're all learners. Let's get better at this. But if you can make the connection, make the connection. So your granddaughter comes to you in a beautiful Easter dress. You can say, well, don't you look darling. That's not wrong. but to say someone must love you for giving you such a lovely dress like that on Easter. Okay, now who's getting the credit? Someone who loves you. You're the recipient of love. It's still a compliment. She knows that I think she looks, what did I say, cute or darling. Yeah. Okay. I'm not against cute. I'm not against darling. I'm in favor of God. It comes from God. I want my granddaughter to see God is being good to you when you have a nice dress like that. Echoing the character qualities of Jesus does not save or justify us. Jesus saves and justifies us. So I'm going to spend the next 10 minutes in Luke, and then we'll take the break if we can. This text reads like this. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector over here. I fast twice a week, I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. So my interest in going to this text is to put some guardrails around this so that, again, we don't so elevate the practice of affirmation that we think practicing affirmation will save our grandchildren. I think lack of practicing affirmation could forfeit for us the opportunity to share with them the gospel if they tune us out. But practicing affirmation does not save us or them. So, in Luke 18, Jesus is speaking to people who talk about God and think they know how to be right with God. And he speaks not about them, but to them. Notice, we'll go back to the text here. He's speaking to whom? Some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous. So this is who he's talking to now. These are people who think, we've got our act pretty much together. We're pretty good before God. Remarkably, the Pharisee not only avoids immoral behaviors and practices good spiritual disciplines, fasts twice a week, but he gives God the credit. We'll see it in the text. God, I thank you that I'm not like those other men, those extortioners, those adulterers. I don't do that bad stuff, and look at the good stuff I do. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. As far as we know, the Pharisee might have believed my past sins were wicked. He might believe that. He might believe in the total sovereignty of God. He might believe Not I, but the grace of God has produced this righteousness. He does thank God for it. His mistake is that he's trusting the wrong thing, the wrong basis, the wrong ground, the wrong righteousness, the wrong person. The God-produced righteousness that the Pharisee trusted was his own. I do this, and I do that, and I don't do this. And I don't do this other thing. He's looking to his own performance. He's giving himself a report card on this. And that was his mistake. And he's dead wrong. Jesus is teaching us that no matter how morally upright we are, or how religiously devout, or how aware we are that God produced our moral appetites and behaviors with an extra blue bullet in there, how much we thank God for them, no matter how much we thank God for them. The amazing thing in that text for me is that the Pharisee thanks God. God, I thank you. I thank you that I'm not like those extortioners. I'm not like those extortioners, but that's because you did this work in me. I'm thanking you, God, that I'm not like those adulterers. I'm not like that tax collector over there. Those things are not the basis of our justification before God. That's not how we are accepted before God. The issue is, are we looking totally away from self and looking to Jesus alone, as we'll see here? The tax collector looks away from his own works to the work of God. Notice, God do something. Not, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this, I've not done that, I've not done that. He just says, God, you got to do it. I got nothing. I got no bargaining chips. I got no cards to play. I got no money to buy spiritual blessings from you. Just be merciful to me. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified. The justification was in his confidence in God's behavior, not his own behavior. So the warning, I'm wanting you very much to go out of here and just be world-class affirmers, but I don't want you to depend on it for your salvation. I don't want you to become self-justified because I'm so good at affirming. Look how God-centered I am in my comments. Not that. Four very sobering words in this text. Rather than the other. One of the men is justified, not the other. And I just put that out there in front of us, including me. What am I relying upon? What am I relying upon? Is it Jesus? Is it Jesus? To repeat, echoing the character qualities of Jesus does not save us or justify us. Jesus saves and justifies us. Even though many relationships fall into trouble over exacting standards, particulars, this is not about lowering standards, just like it wasn't with Wayne. I wasn't trying to say Wayne doesn't have to do his homework. I'm trying to move Wayne in the direction of getting on page 127 with the rest of the class. It's about commending incremental progress towards these standards, all by grace, as God gives enablement. So you can affirm imperfect children, imperfect spouses, imperfect co-workers, imperfect people in your church. They don't have to be perfect before they get commendation from us. The commendation can buy more credibility so that they'll hear us more as we try to encourage them more and more in the direction that we see God already at work in them. So here's how we're going to end this session. Stop and pray for grace to forgive and bless those who have not affirmed you as they should have. All of you are vessels of grace. God's been at work in all of you. And the people around you may not have noticed. And if they noticed, they may not have said anything. And you'd be a better person if they had said something. But they didn't. And so you're left with some of the debris from who they are. Well, it's true for all of us. We need to forgive that and not get hung up over that. So let me pray. Just as we, Father, don't practice affirmation perfectly, neither do the people around us, and we want to cut them plenty of slack now by grace and forgive. We don't want to hold this against them. Some of us have had parents who maybe were drill sergeants toward us. They were tough and not very commendatory toward us. We don't want to be hardened by that. We don't want to be embittered toward them. We want to become what was absent in them, and that'll take a miracle. That's why we're praying for it. We want you to work among us now so that our hearts are free and not tethered to those painful, lingering experiences from yesterday. I ask that it be so in Jesus' name. Amen.